When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to Peoples and Things, where we explore human life with technology. I'm Lee Vinsel. It's a truism in science and technology studies that groups often build politics directly into technologies. Most often, this involves dominant groups designing technologies in ways that favor their own interests and exclude others. In science and technology studies classes, we often use Langdon Winner's famous essay, "Do Artifacts Have Politics?" to introduce students to this idea. Though I am on the team of folks who believe it is a shame that we have this habit, as I'll explain in a moment. Winner's essay, which was first published in 1980, contains a famous example that has been repeated ad infinitum over the years. In it, renowned and infamous city planner Robert Moses decided to build bridges over a Long Island highway so low that buses could not pass them. The idea was that Moses did this to keep poor, especially poor Black people, off the beautiful beaches he had designed. We can think of it as Moses' racist bridges. Now, the problem is that there has always been doubts about whether this story about Moses and his bridges was in fact true. Winner took the story from a biography of Moses and appears to have done no work to verify it, which is pretty common of his work during that period, which generally relied on little to no empirical sleuthing or social scientific digging. You can find skepticism about the truthfulness of Winner's example in another essay, "Do Politics Have Artifacts?" by Bernward Georges. And when I taught science and technology studies at Stevens Institute of Technology in Hoboken, New Jersey, I had students from Long Island say things like, "Dude, I have seen buses go down that road with my own eyeballs." And here is why I think it's unfortunate that we continue to teach students about technology and politics using that Winner essay, because I believe that some areas of science and technology studies have continued traditions of empirical weakness. Indeed, that's part of what this podcast is meant to counter. I try to highlight thinkers who do strong and interesting empirical work. But it seems obviously true that inequalities, including racial inequalities, are built right into the infrastructures and technological systems that surround us. Indeed, that has been the subject of previous episodes of this podcast, including the interviews with Daniel Armanios and Destiny Nock. But how do we study, and importantly to my mind, demonstrate how racist, classist, and other ideological visions get built into such systems? In a series of articles, today's guest, Connor Harrison, Associate Professor of Geography and the School of Earth, Ocean, and Environment at the University of South Carolina, has done just that. Using archival sources, geographic information systems techniques, and other methods, Harrison examines how white folks in control of electrical and lighting system in southern U.S. cities built them in ways that favored their own interests and excluded and disfavored those of Black people, which had long-term consequences probably right down to today. Connor and I also talk about how he got into this work and what he's been working on more recently. And it's funny, I was introduced to Connor by geographer Liz Hennessy 10 years ago. I looked it up today. So it was especially fun to finally connect to Connor and talk to him about his good work. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Hey. Get excited! Connor, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
I was thinking we might start our conversation by focusing on your article, Race, Space, and Electric Power, Jim Crow, and the 1934 North Carolina Rural Electrification Survey. So tell us a bit about that piece. What does the survey allow us to see about the themes you wanted to get into?
So the piece itself, it came out of my dissertation work, which, you know, started from, you know, after doing my master's, which looked at this question of energy poverty or energy vulnerability. I just found that, you know, like a lot of things that started to open up a lot of more questions, including specifically, you know, there was this really uneven pricing in electricity systems across the eastern part of North Carolina compared to the big investor-owned utilities. And so, you know, scratching the surface, as I did kind of in my master's about some of the reasons for that, I wanted to investigate more. And what that then led me to was just kind of opening up the insane world of electric utilities, all of the different varieties, all the different ways that they're regulated or not regulated, and all the kind of questions that come from that. So I just had this question of, okay, so where did this system come from? You know, that we kind of take for granted today in some ways. Times is kind of invisible, but it's getting much more visible, I think, in a lot of people's lives.
Yeah.
At times. And I think along the way, I was really fortunate. So I just had that kind of basic question. I was fortunate along the way in my graduate program that some of my colleagues, a lot of whom have gone on to be sort of really key figures in study of Black geographies, pushed me and said, you know, there's got to be something else going on here. It's not just kind of your basic political economy story. Hmm. And, you know, it is a political economy story in a lot of ways. But they, you know, as they started to encourage me to think about it, I started to think about some of these overlaps of sort of the progressive era of Jim Crow how that overlapped with the, you know, the rollout of electricity systems in the U.S. this early part of the 20th century. And it was kind of with that I would go to the archives. All this work was archival and just kind of have that in my mind, right? Mm-hmm. And just, you know, where can I see this? How can I see this? And sort of in the end, I found way more than I wanted to. And I felt like uncovered some pretty interesting stories, I guess.
Yeah, you sure did, man. And so for this article in particular, where were the archives? I mean, where were you doing the research for it?
Sure. So a lot of this one came from the State of North Carolina Archives in Raleigh, North Carolina. Mm-hmm. They have a big archive. And as I was, you know, they have a big collection on the rural electrification of the state. And, you know, there's tons and tons of documents in there.
Yeah.
And what I kept finding was references to this survey. Mm-hmm. And the sort of early stuff I was looking at, they were talking about this survey, and I thought, oh, it'd be really interesting to find the survey or find the results, you know, this book that they published. And so I found the book, and then I was like, it'd be really interesting if I could find, you know, the data that they used on this. Well, I found, you know, thousands and thousands of boxes of the raw, you know, material.
Yeah.
That the surveyors, I found all the instructions that they gave to the surveyors. I found all this correspondence about it. And it was sort of in digging in there that, you know, I found this kind of how this survey was done. And I mean, I can go into that if you want.
Yeah. Well, go for it. Okay. Yeah.
So the survey itself, what it was meant to do, it was put together by a guy named David Weaver, who was a professor at North Carolina State University and was over their extension service, their agricultural extension service. And he kind of headed up North Carolina's rural electrification, which actually predates the federal program
right.
by about a year.
Mm-hmm.
Weaver went on to work for the federal program.
Okay.
And so this, I think, was a little bit of a test case for how they could decide where they were going to roll out electricity lines in the state. So what the survey was meant to do is it went basically house to house along rural roads and surveyed households about and collected just, I think I looked earlier, it was 26 different data points. They surveyed over 25,000 households across the state. So it's a really massive undertaking. And part of it was kind of a back to work program during the Depression to find employment for some of these surveyors. But what they ended up looking at is collecting all this data about the houses themselves, how big it was, if they had farm animals, how many farm animals, how much acreage they had devoted to different crops and so on. And then they asked questions like, if you had electricity, would you use an iron or would you use a refrigerator or would you use these different things? And then they took all this information and, in the instructions, you can see how they would then assign, okay, this person says that they're going to use an iron, so that's worth 1 kilowatt hour a month. And they kind of add it all up and then assign a certain amount of electricity use to that home. Well, the other thing that they collected was the type of, I guess, the housing tenure. So if it was owned or rented, as well as the race of the occupant. They also gave a grade, like an A, B, C, D grade, to the condition of the house, as well as to the quality of the interview. And this was kind of like, is this the house look nice, or was the person seem forthright or truthful? And what was sort of the big finding, I think, for this paper was that they had collected all this information and said, X house is going to use 100 kilowatt hours a month or whatever. And then they used the house was rented or owned, and they had this kind of matrix and then they used the race of the householder. And then using that, they created this matrix, and based on the grade, they would then assign this number that they called the correction factor. And basically what the correction factor says is that if you were white and a homeowner and they thought the condition of your house was good and the quality of the interview was good, they would multiply that number that they calculated by 1. So it would stay the same. If you were a black tenant farmer, even if they thought that the condition of the house was great and the quality of the interview was good, they would then multiply that electricity usage by 0.8. So, all things being equal, just for the fact of kind of, the race of the occupant of the house, they were systematically lowering the amount of electricity that these houses would consume in their calculations. Mm-hmm. Why does this matter then? Is that they looked and they'd along each of these lines, and then a lot of the lines, and this is in the eastern part of North Carolina, Edgecombe County, which is where Rocky Mount is located. Along these lines that had a large number of African Americans, they were sort of systematically lowered in the ranking of how much electricity they were consumed, and therefore quite likely when they went to build the lines, those places were going to receive lower priority for receiving electrification.
Right. That's pretty amazing, man. I mean, and so you see, you see reflections on race in these records you were looking on, it's not just a box to check, right?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, very much so. They spoke pretty extensively about it. One of the other things that I drew on was this interesting research that was done by a sociologist at University of North Carolina back in the late 1920s, early 1930s, named Wiley Sanders. And this was in a different archive. But he asked all these different government agents, government representatives, extension agents, all sorts of different sort of elected officials about their opinions on race. These are the people that were creating these surveys, that were administering these surveys, and the sort of views that they had, when they were allowed to anonymously give them, were really just abhorrent.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, the likelihood that you would even be able to get an A, right, as your grade was really low, just based on the people who were out there kind of surveying you.
Yeah. So you're a geographer, and I'm embarrassed to say that you might be the first geographer I've had on the show so far. So, but can you tell us a bit about how this piece fits into a kind of like larger conversations going on in geography for people who don't know that field very well?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, there's, you know, geography, I think, is, you know, there's, you can think about it in terms of kind of physical geography, which is very much, you know, things like environmental science, how water, you know, moves through the environment. You don't think a lot about people. There's GI science, which is using GIS mapping to kind of, you know, actually physically map things. And I actually use a little bit of GIS in this paper, just sort of. So there's historical GIS, which takes older documents and digitizes them and brings them up to, not necessarily up to date, but allows you to visualize things that happened in the past. And then there's this whole other world of kind of human geography, which can be broken into any variety of subsets, like, you know, economic geography, cultural, you know, on and on. I'm sort of somewhere between an economic, cultural geographer, I would say. Mm-hmm. And I think where I sort of fit most is in what's kind of known as energy geography. And, you know, there's been some work in the last, you know, decade and a half that's started to look at these questions of energy and how space is involved, right? Because, you know, that's one of the things that geographers are concerned about. So both in how energy sort of produces particular types of landscapes that we see, as well as vice versa, right? How our energy systems are shaped by the landscapes in which they're, you know, embedded in. Mm-hmm. So I think broadly it fits in there. Where my work has kind of been, I think, sought or found inspiration is by, you know, geographers that have tried to dig a little bit deeper and not just think about energy as a variable or as a, you know, a raw material that we study, but think about how energy is part of the, you know, underlies or supports the social theories that we use. So in this particular article, I draw on actually some anthropologists who use this idea of energy power.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I've never known how to say that either.
I know. I don't either. But, you know, thinking about the energetic basis of our social theories, and that this is something that, you know, people like Matt Huber, who's at Syracuse, has written a few books looking at oil. You know, non-geographers are also doing this work.
Yeah.
Timothy Mitchell, for example, his work on carbon democracy, and Dipesh Chakrabarty has done some work on this, you know, so rethinking kind of how energy fits into kind of our modern society, and I think also kind of the making of our modern society,
yep,
which is kind of where I'm interested in here.
Yeah, and so how'd you get started down the road doing this work? I mean, you did a master's degree on energy poverty, is that right?
That's correct, yeah. So I did my master's at East Carolina University. I'm a North Carolina native.
Okay.
And my partner is from the eastern part of the state. She's from Kinston, North Carolina, which is a small town. And, you know, we were in Greenville, which is about 45 minutes from Kinston. And I went to, you know, for my master's thinking I was going to be an urban planner. And pretty quickly figured out kind of what it was that geographers did, you know, what professors do.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly, you know, kind of became very much interested in that. And one of the things that was always, you know, kind of on my mind was, you know, my partner's mother is a school teacher, single mother, and was always talking about how expensive it was to heat and cool her house.
Yep.
And, the bills that she would then describe were just astronomical. She used fuel oil for heating. This is like 2007, 2008, oil prices at an all-time high. And so it was just, this sort of thing was kind of in the back of my mind. When it came time to pick a thesis topic, I was just using academic search engines and typed in the two terms energy and poverty. And I came across an article by a guy named Stefan Buzarovsky, which was looking at this in Eastern Europe and post-socialist Eastern Europe. I read it and was just like, this is what I want to do. And thought that, you know, looked around, nobody had done anything like this in the US or in specifically in North Carolina. And I thought it'd be perfect kind of opportunity to dig in.
Yeah. And so you have an article from like 2011. And I think I mistyped down the title. It's because like you have to have heat. Is that what it's called?
Yeah. You got to have heat.
You got it. Yeah.
And so that was comes out of the work that I did on that, the field work that I did. And that was primarily, in-depth interviews with people who had received weatherization assistance from the weatherization assistance program. So increasing the energy efficiency of houses. And that was, really sort of eye-opening for me, talking to people about their experiences with energy and thinking about how it's this mix of kind of the energy system, right, which in the eastern part of the state is pretty screwed up, but also kind of their housing situation, a lot of people living in mobile homes, as well as, their kind of what we call personal biographies. So, the life situation that people find themselves in.
Yeah, it's funny. So one of my guests I had on was Destiny Knock. She's a
yes.
Okay, she's an engineering professor at Carnegie Mellon, or at least was when we chatted. And she's been working on energy poverty. I mean, there's folks out there. It's like a topic, but it's not big. And the reason I'm going down this line of thought is it's something you kind of mentioned in that paper yours is I feel like, especially if you're a New York Times reader, we hear about climate change and climate policy all the time. And I know there are people who are thinking about how climate policy is going to affect the poor, but I don't actually see it covered that often. And meanwhile, I mean, as your piece and, Destiny and other people, there's real climate or real energy poverty out there, right? I mean, this is a real issue already. Before we start doing climate things and potentially raising prices. So, yeah, it's a pretty big deal.
Yeah, and I will say, this is the benefit of getting older, right? I think the attention to it has really increased, certainly since I started doing it. Just this maybe a year or two ago, there's this idea of a just transition, which is primarily thinking about labor, but I think it also is applicable to thinking about low-income households, particularly as we enter this era of the Inflation Reduction Act and the IRA. So many of our ways that we're trying to incentivize people to use solar on their house or to get a heat pump, it's all around tax credits. And not exclusively. I know that there's other, but that's what you hear about you can get a rebate, you can get a tax credit, you can do this. I'm involved in a project right now that's funded by the Sloan Foundation. And we're actually going back and doing some of the work that I was doing. We're doing interviews with low-income folks in South Carolina and Tennessee. And some of the stories that we're hearing, about it's so far away from the sorts of things that you hear commonly associated with the IRA about how it's going to help, decarbonize. I mean, these are people who are living, without running water, without, any source of heat, who, suffer kind of disconnections constantly. Mm-hmm. So real challenges that people are facing.
Yeah. So is part of why you moved into the historical research, I'm just kind of trying to chart out your career. So you get this master's, there's this 2011 piece that comes out of that. And then, were you starting to think about like the historical processes that led to the situation that you had studied in your master's? Is that kind of how your thinking developed?
Yeah, very much so.
Okay.
That was kind of, I was like, okay, how did this happen?
Yeah.
I knew that I had learned along the way that there was this, really uneven electricity pricing in the eastern part of the state. A lot of that was rooted in that there are these municipal electricity systems in North Carolina. So just like, you know, the city might provide you with water or trash, they are the company that you buy your electricity yep. from. In the early 1980s, these municipal electricity systems invested in a big nuclear power project in North Carolina, the Sharon Harris Nuclear Power Plant. If you know anything about kind of your nuclear history, it was a plant that was way over budget.
Yeah, yeah.
Much later than it was supposed
They're
to be.
Expensive. Yeah.
Very expensive. I think they initially, you know, the overall project was going to be $1 billion for four reactors, and they got one reactor for four.
Oh, shit. Oh, that's bad.
Yeah, so not so good.
Wow.
And, you know, it was sort of a co-investment with the utility. It's now part of Duke Energy, but called Carolina Power and Light. But the way that it was structured is that these municipalities all were going to pay this off, pay this debt off that they accrued through their electricity bills. And then once you, so they started doing this, and it was based on, so they were paying it off based on the size of the city, the size of the, you know, so some of the towns ranged from, you know, something like Rocky Mount, where I did some of my research, is on the big side. It's about 70,000.
Yeah.
I remember there was one town called Hobgood, tiny little town, 900 people had invested in this. So they all had a certain amount of debt that they had to pay off. And then that was just basically spread out along their electricity consumers. And what's sort of notable is that some of these cities actually had significant declines in their population. For example, Kinston, where my partner's from, started with a population of about 30,000 when they made the investment. Uh-huh. By the time I was working on it, it was, they'd lost about a third of the people there.
Yeah.
It's down to about 20,000 people.
Yeah.
Other places, kind of some of the suburbs outside of Raleigh, like Apex and Wake Forest, went from 2,000 to 150,000, and it wasn't such a big deal.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Maybe not 150,000, but significantly bigger.
Yeah.
So this was crippling. So your electricity rates would be 50, 60, 70, 80% higher than what it would be if you were from the investor owned utility.
Wow.
Had big impacts on these towns for a long time.
Yeah. That's wild, man. And so was part of what you were interested in is the development of that kind of municipal electricity system. Like why are these things the thing that,
Yeah. And that was very much it. I was like, oh, there are these municipal systems. Oh, there are these rural electric cooperatives. Oh, there's the investor owned utilities. And sort of along the way, kind of learning how it was that race kind of cuts across those systems. The municipal system is one thing that, they typically ran these at a profit, right? So the town would run it, so you'd have a surplus, and then rather than raising property taxes on all the property owners, you would just take it out of the they'd shift the money over from the electricity fund to the general fund, which is, a fairly regressive way to tax people.
Yeah.
Favored those who were owning property, which were primarily, the white people in the town. So, as I started to kind of look, I just found these patterns kind of again and again in the different places I was looking.
Wow. So, a couple of your pieces, at least a couple of the pieces, look at Rocky Mount as like your place. So how'd you end up focusing on Rocky Mount? Like, what's that story?
That's a great question. I was trying to remember today, actually. Rocky Mount, well, a couple of things. I mean, sometimes I think most people would say when you're doing research, you dig sort of broadly, and you just, at a certain point, you just find a lot of information.
Yeah, you find that rich vein, right? Yep.
Yeah. And, I looked in some other towns as well in my sort of broader dissertation. I looked at Wilson, I looked at Kinston. But there was just a lot of information about, Rocky Mount, particularly the municipality. So some of the work I did was in the archival work I did was in the city clerk's office, where they had this basically bank vault in their in the building, and they said, you know, you can go in there and look at whatever you want.
Oh man, yeah, that's what you want.
I spent a couple of weeks there looking at the meeting minutes from the city council. Uh-huh. And that's where I found sort of every time somebody came and requested electricity, and then I kind of cross-referenced that with city directories to figure out where that person lived, and kind of pulled that together. I also did a lot of research at the historical collection at the UNC libraries. You know, I was a grad student at UNC Chapel Hill, and they had a ton of stuff about Rocky Mount as well. There was a big mill there. They had a bunch of collections from the mill, and Rocky Mount's an interesting place because it's really been kind of a, oddly for not a big place, it's been kind of a center of power, it has produced a lot of powerful people in the state and state politics. In fact, the current governor of North Carolina, Roy Cooper, is from Nash County. Rocky Mount's right on the county line between Edgecombe and Nash County.
What kind of mills were there?
Textile.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's right on the, it's kind of as far east as you can go. So there's like a little bit of a fall line there. Mm-hmm. So there was a small mill that also had some electricity production. And there was a small mill town that was later absorbed into the city.
Okay.
The city overall. So it was an interesting place. I thought it was sort of captured these kind of small town dynamics that I was seeing all over the eastern part of North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, being in South Carolina, it's very similar to some of these same size cities that I see here as well.
Mm-hmm. You have a cool piece about Rocky Mount called "Extending the White Way." That's about like street lighting there and their attempts to adopt electric street lighting. So that was cool. Was that using those city records that you were finding, or?
Yes, that was using the city records to trace the Rocky Mount part of it. One of the things that came up again and again is that they referred to these street lighting systems as the White Way.
Right.
And I thought, well, this is
that means more than one thing here in right?
Yeah. So it I was like, well, this there's got to be more to this. And so to learn more about that, I actually went to an archive that's in Schenectady, New York, which is where General Electric was headquartered. And there's a museum there, and they've got this really big GE archive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just tried to go and find whatever I could about these street lighting systems. Yeah. And found, of course, way more than I thought I would ever find. And kind of went into, you know, different types of illumination and how the measuring it and how they were selling it. And, you know, kind of, that was an interesting kind of detour I wasn't expecting.
Was the White Way kind of like a package that GE was selling?
Yes, the White Way was a package. It included, I think it included a generator. It included a system of lighting. They had all kinds of specifications about, you know, on Main Street, you need to have this many lumens or this many light posts per mile or however they measured it out. There was some interesting kind of figures who were like the GE kind of, you know, developers of this. A guy named D.R.C. Ryan, I think his name was, who you know, was going around selling these systems. And of course there was competition from other types of lighting systems. But the White Way, I think it was maybe the most successful. It was sold all over the Northeast, Midwest, and into the South.
Yeah, I feel like you bump into it in electricity histories. It's just been a while since. Well, that's cool. And so how did it connect to race in the town? I mean, so it's too rich immediately, right? It's like, well, the White Way means something different, and you know.
Yes. So, well, I did kind of two different things in thinking about Rocky Mount. So, you know, it was like collecting these requests. You know, where did the person live that was making the request? And then, you know, looking about whether or not the request was granted by the city council, the all-white city council, who would say, yes, you get electricity, or no, you don't. And I thought, well, this is a way that we can kind of think about this very directly.
Yeah.
So there's part of it looks at that. With the white way, you know, it's thinking about how electricity was used at that time, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so part of it is, you know, thinking about how parts of cities become racialized, right? So how can the main street become this place of light night and day? You know, light we've come to associate with things like safety, with wealth, with you know all kinds of kind of improvement, progress.
Yeah.
You know, so certain parts of the city then become coded, I think, through the rollout of electricity, not just sort of individual households, but sort of these commercial districts.
Yep.
Become coded. Neighborhoods. I also looked at how the white way or these street lighting systems were you know, they become, so these neighborhoods become coded. At the same time, right, so you have these sort of centers of white privilege. You also have these places that are, you know, don't receive electricity. And then sort of they can start to become, well, that place is dangerous. You wouldn't go there. That place is where, you know, those people live. And that's not a place that you go. And so, you know, pretty quickly, you know, some of these neighborhoods becomes quite stark, the differences between kind of the way that electricity can kind of make those differences quite clear, right? Not only during the day now, but also at night, right? So you have all of this privilege that gets kind of accrued on into certain parts of the city.
Yeah. Wow, man. And so, you know, you wrote about the, I just want to make sure we hit all the kind of electricity points there too. So, is part of the what you're talking about these decisions, there's this board of commissioners who's making decisions about who gets it. Is that what you were referring to earlier with this council?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So it's the county commission or the, well, I guess it was the city council. I can't remember what they were called, the city commissioners or something at the time. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was these people who were literally making the decisions about who got electricity and who didn't.
So late in prepping for this, just before I came over here, I noticed that you, in some of the materials sent over, that you'd written a chapter simply called Wires. What was that for? I didn't have to.
Yeah.
I read
yeah,
the first
okay.
couple pages. I'm like, this is wild. This is good.
Yeah. So Wires. Okay. So after I finished at UNC and before I started here at South Carolina, I had a fellowship. I was a visiting fellow at Lancaster University in the UK, and they had a research center that was called Demand. Demand stood for something, but it was a energy demand research center. There was a couple that the UK government funded. And it was run by a geographer named Gordon Walker and a sociologist named Elizabeth Shove, who wrote Comfort, Cleanliness, and Convenience. And so they were interested in energy demand. And so I came over and spent, you know, maybe 8 weeks there, something like that. And I was presenting some of my work. And I distinctly remember Elizabeth, who was the editor of the book chapter, saying, you know, this is all great, but the thing that I keep wondering is, where are the wires in this article? And I was like, I don't know. That's a really good question. So I was like, okay, yeah, where are the wires? And so I spent some more kind of archival work again at the GE archives up in Schenectady. I went back and looked at the history of both kind of the development of transmission wires. Mm-hmm. So all the kind of insulation, as well as household wiring. And, you know, household wiring kind of has this, like anticipatory effect. So, I mean, I always think of it as like, you know, no matter how big your refrigerator is, mm-hmm. you're always going to fill it up with stuff. And, you know, a lot of stuff's going to go bad.
Yeah.
Right. And I, in some ways, I think that, what GE and other, you know, electric appliance manufacturers, electricity companies did is they got into the building codes in a lot of houses and they started to say, okay, your wires need to be big. You know, they need to have a lot of capacity. You need to have this many outlets on your wall. You need to have this type of switch, you know, light switch on there. The type of switch that we use, the kind of on off is known as the convenience switch. And, you know, it was sold by, you know, you could just use your elbow to do it.
Right,
so
right.
You know, the housewife's hands are full, so she can just use her elbow to turn it off and on. But I think the idea was you put outlets, you wire these houses up, you put them everywhere, and pretty soon everyone's going to be using all of them. You don't want to run into a situation where they can't plug something in into their house.
No.
And then we also at the same time need to have, you know, the big capacity transmission wires to move electricity, you know, really long distances, you know, from hydro or wherever. And we're talking about transmission still, right. Moving, renewables and so on. But that was, that was kind of my detour into wires.
It's a fun piece, man. It's cool.
Yeah, it was really interesting, really interesting to work on. And the collection, it's in this edited book that's quite interesting collection, I think.
Oh, what's it called? Or what's the, I didn't have a chance to cross-reference
you. It is called, you're going to have to edit this. Let me go look at my bookshelf real quick.
No, it's okay. Don't worry about it.
I think it's called Infrastructures in Practice.
Okay.
It's edited by Elizabeth Shove and Frank Trentman, who's a historian in the UK someplace.
One of the reasons I liked it when I was I was a research assistant to this historian of technology and business named Richard John, between undergrad and grad school, and I did research for him in Chicago in the kind of Chicago City Council papers for his book that became Network Nation, which is about telegraph and telephone systems.
Oh, interesting.
And so I was looking through all the city council stuff from the late 19th and early 20th century, and as these systems are coming online, telephone and electricity systems, and wires were a big deal for the city council because there was no standard approach to how you deal with this. You know, there's no kind of like right of way, you know, like all the, you know, there's no the poles. They didn't know how to think about it yet. And there was also just systems that you, like there was this, I remember this one pharmacist built his own telephone system that just ran from his office, his store, to his house, which was like a couple blocks away, just so he and his wife could call back and forth in the middle of the day, right? But like, this is just like, that doesn't happen anymore. I mean, we don't do that, but was not happening very often. Even then, you know, it wasn't like people were building. So the city council just did not know how to think about these things.
It's amazing. I mean, I always remember back to as I was reading about wires. If you look at the, I think, you know, early sort of Edison systems, he lit, I think it was one of the Vanderbilt's house. And it was this party, this big party, but Edison had a crew of like 30 people who were running around putting out all fires, like literal fires the whole time.
Yeah.
Because the wires weren't insulated. They were just bare copper wires running around. They don't come out fully formed, right? These ideas.
No. Yeah. I mean, that's the other joke I like to make with my students is like, you know, we have fuses, but they didn't have fuses initially. That was like something they figured out. And they could have, I mean, learning how to use an electricity system so you don't overload it could have been something we were trained of as children, right? But we decided to automate that. It's better not to have to think about that. Fuses are way better than having to think about what's happening with the load all the time, right?
Yeah, for sure. Like, why does this keep turning off?
Yeah. So your work has shifted over time and you kind of have a lot of different things going on. So, you know, what are you up to these days and kind of like where are you at with things?
So I think the one, I have shifted a lot, just I think as sort of interests and opportunities have taken me in different, directions. But I think the common theme has primarily been questions of energy, and then I think its relationship to questions of inequality, I think has been sort of the driving way. You know, the big project that I'm maybe I'll say two-thirds of the way finished with right now is a project that's looking at how the finance sector is interacting with the energy transition, maybe driving the energy transition, or at least shaping it. And the way that I came to this was, I don't know, it was probably 5 or 6 years ago. I'd been teaching energy classes for a while, felt like I knew everything, but, you know, I had been doing all this research, historical research on the electricity sector. And then I kind of had to become honest with myself and realize that I didn't totally understand how it worked, particularly this mix of sort of regulated and deregulated systems that we have, you know, all the different markets, all the acronyms, all the sort of thousands of things that are out there.
Yeah.
So I just kind of set in mind that I was going to try to actually figure it out. Then I had a kind of spark of an idea where I was working on a class and an economic geography class and working with one of the librarians here. And they showed me these business databases where you could look at equities analyst reports. So people who say you should buy this stock or you should buy that stock. And I was looking at one for NextEra Energy, Florida-based company that owns Florida Power and Light, is also the world's largest owner of renewable energy. At the time, it had also just been revealed that they had been behind a ballot initiative in Florida that was trying to get people to vote against being allowed to put rooftop solar on your house.
Yeah, they don't want that, man.
Yeah. So in my mind, I was like, this is weird. You know, you have the world's largest owner of renewable energy convincing people to vote against the ability to use solar energy on their own house.
Yeah.
And I was just like, this doesn't make sense until it's somewhat obvious. As I was reading this analyst report, and they don't care, right? That all they want to know is this company going to be successful or are they going to be profitable? They said they caught some flack for this, but in the end, it's good for them.
Huh.
Because, you know, they'll stay in control of their electricity production. And that was sort of when the light bulb went off in my head and said, well, maybe if we were to start with, you know, these financial people who are only interested in kind of, you know, the sort of profitability really of the electricity system, maybe then we can make sense of how it's changing or how it's not changing. And so that was sort of the starting point. And I got some funding from the National Science Foundation to do the work. And I've been working on it for the last few years. And some of it's been historical, looking at contemporaries of Enron during the deregulation in the late 1990s. Some of it's been more contemporary, doing a lot of interviews with people that work in the private equity industry, for example, and how they've started to invest in solar. So I've got, it's, you know, ideally going to be a book project, working on all that right now.
Cool, man. That sounds great.
Yeah. So that's what I'm kind of primarily working on, is getting that finished, getting that out for review.
Good luck. We'll definitely have to have you on when that comes out. That sounds wonderful.
Yeah, well, let's just hope it comes out.
Fingers crossed. I'll send you good vibes, man.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Connor, this has been great. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
Okay, yeah, thanks for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of our podcast. You can reach us with questions, comments, and suggestions at leeinsel@gmail.com or by following me on Twitter at STS_news or on YouTube at People's Things. Our podcast is distributed by the New Books Network, the leading platform for academic podcasts, so that you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. People's and Things, like most things in this world, depends on the work of many people. I want to thank my brother Jake Vinsel for writing the music for the show. I want to thank my buddy Juliana Castro for designing the logos for the podcast. you can check out her work at julianacastro.co. Joe Fort is the producer for the podcast, and Mandy Lamb is the production assistant. This podcast and other Peoples and Things programming are produced in affiliation with Virginia Tech Publishing and supported by the Center for Humanities and the University Libraries at Virginia Tech. For information about other podcasts from Virginia Tech Publishing, visit publishing.vt.edu. For the entire Peoples and Things team, I am Lee Vinsel. And most importantly, I want to thank you for listening. Thanks.